then said how panic attacks were... I can't remember what she said, but she calmed down and made me pull over so we wouldn't have to drive into the city. But Pete, that was sad. She's so small, and she's... You see her online, and... Vicky fell silent. She sat up straighter and drove with one hand. The other hand was touching her chin. Her elbow was on the armrest next to her. They drove along for quite a while. Finally, Vicky said, looking straight ahead at the road, "She's not cuckoo, Pete. She just couldn't stand being back here. It was too hard for her." On his trips to the soup kitchen in Carlisle with the Guptills, Pete had noticed how they were affectionate toward each other. Shirley would often put her hand on Tommy's arm as he drove the car. Pete wondered about this, what it would be like to be that free, to touch people so freely. He would have liked, only not really, to put his own hand on his sister's arm right now, this sister who had put on lipstick to see the famous Lucy. Instead, he sat quietly next to her. Eventually, Vicky said, "I never should have mentioned that stuff from the past." "No, Vicky, how would you know?" "And I said the stuff about the clothes." As they drove, the sun was glaring to their side. They passed once again the barns with the American flags painted on them, only they were on the other side of them now. And Pete saw once again from across the road the huge John Deere place, with all its green and yellow machines. He felt awfully safe sitting next to Vicky. He kept wondering how he could tell her this, and he finally said, "Vicky, you're great." She made a sound of disgust and glanced at him, and he said, "No, really, you are. Lucy said to remind you of the Anne Marie woman." "Anna Marie?" Then Vicky said, "What did she mean by that?"
"I think she meant that you were great, too. That's what I think she was saying."
Pete moved his feet around the cans that were on the floor there. They drove in silence for many miles. From the corner of his eye, he watched his sister. He thought she was a good driver. He liked her bulkiness, the way she filled her seat and drove with such authority. He wished he could tell her this. He wished he could say something more than that she was great. He finally said,
"Vicky, we didn't turn out so bad, you know."
She glanced at him and rolled her eyes.
"Yeah, right," she said.
Then she said, "Well, we're not out there murdering people, if that's what you mean." She gave a brief laugh. It seemed to rise up from the deepest part of herself. Pete wished the ride could go on forever. He wished he could sit there next to his sister while they drove and drove. But he recognized where they were now. The roads were narrowing. He saw the top of a maple tree that had started to turn pink. He saw the fields that surrounded the Petersons' barn. And then, finally, they were back. Vicky pulled into the road, and then the driveway, and there in front of them was the tired little house with its blinds open. Vicky turned the car off. After a moment, Pete said,
"Hey, Vicky, do you want that rug?"
Vicky pushed her glasses up her nose with a finger placed in the middle of them.
"Sure, why not?"
she said. But she made no move to get out of the car. And so they gazed at the house in silence and sat. Dottie's Bed and Breakfast. They were from the East, and their name was Small. This Dottie always remembered, because the husband was so big, and he wore a look of fixed irritation that must have come, at least partly, Dottie imagined, from a lifetime of responding to comments regarding his name. Which, of course, Dottie took no part in, not one bit, at all. Mrs. Small had made the reservation over the telephone, so Dottie knew they weren't young. Not only Mrs. Small's voice told her this, but most people did things online now. Dottie was, in fact, a bit older than Mrs. Small. But Dottie had taken to the internet like a paddlefish waiting for water. She was sorry it hadn't arrived when she was a younger woman. She was certain she could have been successful at something that made use of her mind more than the renting out of rooms for these past many years. She could have been rich. But Dottie was not a woman to complain, having been taught by her decent Aunt Edna one summer. It seemed like 100 years ago, and practically was, that a complaining woman was like pushing dirt beneath the fingernails of God. And this was an image Dottie had never been able to fully dislodge. Dottie was a tiny woman, prim, with the good skin of her Midwestern ancestors. And all things considered, and there were many things to consider, she appeared, to herself and to others, to do just fine. In the event, the reservation was made for Mr. and Mrs. Small, and 2 weeks later a tall, big, white-haired man stepped through the door and said, "We have a reservation for Dr. Richard Small." Dr. Small's announcement was apparently large enough to include his wife, who came in right behind him, without any mention of her at all. Standing at the front desk, he did the registering with terrible penmanship, irritation oozing out of him, while Mrs. Small, who was very thin and had a look of general nervousness about her, glanced politely around the lounge, and then became interested in the old photographs of the theater that were on the wall. And she seemed to especially like a photograph of the library that was hanging near them. The photo showed the library back in 1940, looking brick and ivy old-fashioned. So Dottie had a sense about this woman and her husband right away. Of course, in Dottie's business, she would have a sense about people right away. Sometimes, of course, Dottie had been very wrong. With the Smalls, she was not wrong. Dr. Small complained immediately about the room having no luggage rack for him to place his suitcase on. And naturally, Dottie did not say, "That's what happens when you have your wife call and ask for the cheapest room." Instead, she said she had another room at the end of the hall that might serve them better. It was the bunny rabbit room. That's what she called it, due to the fact that in the past she'd had a habit of collecting stuffed toy bunnies. Her husband had given her one each holiday, and friends had, too. So later, Dottie put them all in one room. And really, people went crazy for them sometimes. Women did. And gay men. They got quite imaginative with all those bunnies around, having them talking in different voices and so forth. Dottie used to have a comment book, until people wrote things about seeing ghosts in the bunny rabbit room and other foolishness. But the bunny rabbit room had two beds and a low chest on which Dr. Small could place his suitcase, and that evening Dottie heard through the walls a constant, thin-voiced monologue coming from Mrs. Small, with only once or twice a short answer from her husband. Dottie could not make out many words, but she understood that he was here for the cardiology convention and was not staying in the large hotel in town where the meeting was taking place. Most likely, Dottie thought, because he was getting old and was no longer really respected. And he could not stand that. Could not put up with seeing younger colleagues laughing together in the evenings. And so he had come here, to Dottie's bed and breakfast, where he could be not noticeably unimportant. "A physician," she imagined him saying at breakfast, because this is what all male doctors said when they didn't want you to think they were academics. To whom, Dottie had come to understand, physicians seemed to feel very superior. Dottie didn't care one way or another anymore, whom anyone felt superior to. But in this business, you did notice things. Even if you kept your eyes squeezed shut, you would still notice things in this business. And the time of Dr. Small, Dottie thought, his own personal history in time, his own career, had passed, and he couldn't stand it. She was sure he made huge fusses about computerized records, the cost of the practice, the fact that he no longer made as much money. Well, she did not feel sorry for him. But his wife surprised her. When Dottie saw couples like Mr. and Mrs. Small, she was sometimes comforted that her painful divorce years earlier had at least prevented her from becoming a Mrs. Small. In other words, a nervous, slightly whiny woman whose husband ignored her and so naturally made her more anxious. This you saw all the time. And when Dottie saw it, she was reminded that almost always, oddly, she thought it was odd, she seemed a stronger person without her husband, even though she missed him every day. But in fact, Mrs. Small, during breakfast, her husband was not talking to her, but instead looking through a binder that perhaps contained his materials for the day, broke into song. She had been glancing through a stack of old theater programs Dottie kept in a basket, and while she was waiting for her toast, she called out, "Oh, I love that Gilbert and Sullivan!" And she started singing a chorus from HMS Pinafore, with two other guests sitting a table away. Dottie thought Dr. Small would stop her, but he sang a few bars with her, and that warmed Dottie's heart. It did, though she was always nervous, naturally, about the comfort of other guests. But the others didn't seem to mind, or even really to notice, people being, as Dottie knew, mostly very involved with themselves. Oatmeal for Dr. Small, and whole wheat toast for his wife, who Dottie noticed was wearing all black. And in a few minutes his wife said, "Richard, look! Annie Appleby! Look, it says right here, she was Martha Cratchit in A Christmas Carol 8 years ago. Look!" She gave the program a little punch with her finger. Then he took the program from her. "Everything all right, then?" Dottie asked, placing the food on the table. Almost in a British way, she liked to say that, though Dottie had never been to England in her life. Mrs. Small's eyes were shiny as she turned to Dottie. "Annie Appleby used to be a friend of ours. Well, she was someone we knew. She was someone we..." Her husband cut her off with a subtle gesture of the sort that long-married couples can use with each other, and they finished their breakfast in silence. Mid-morning, they left the house together. They left the house, which is what everyone who came there did, leave. Dottie was always reminded that people were there to visit others, or, as in the case of the Smalls, to be part of their business world, or frequently to see their children at the college. Whatever it was, they were connected to something in the little city of Jennisburg, Illinois. They stepped out into the street with a purpose. The big oak door closing, accentuating this. The muffling of voices the moment they were on the front porch. The inescapable whisper of abandonment. Well, that was part of the business, too. Mrs. Small came back alone right after lunch. She undid the scarf from around her neck and dallied a bit in the lounge, looking at the old photos on the wall, while Dottie worked behind the desk. "I'm Shelley," said Mrs. Small. "I don't know if I properly introduced myself before." Dottie said it was lovely having her stay, and continued with her business. People sometimes got confused in a B&B, not knowing how friendly they should be. And Dottie understood this. She tried to give allowances. In Dottie's youth, she had been extremely poor. And for many years afterward, more than needed to be, whenever she went into a store, whether a dress shop or the butcher's or a pastry shop or a department store, she expected to be watched and then asked to leave. Dottie held this indignity dear. Anyone who came into her B&B was never to feel that way. And Shelley Small, who gave no indication of having suffered poverty of any kind, though, of course, one never knew, was really very nervous. Dottie was aware of that. In a few minutes, Shelley brought up the actress Annie Appleby again. As she stood looking at the photo of the theater, Shelley said to Dottie, but without looking at Dottie, "I think about Annie a lot, much more than I need to. Let's just say that." She gave Dottie a quick smile then, and what passed over her face was a look that caused Dottie to feel for a moment as if a small fish had swum through her stomach, a feeling she recognized as a symptom of, well, almost pity. Though pity was a confusing thing, and Dottie would hate for people to pity her, as she knew had been done in the past. Dottie suddenly asked the woman if she would like a cup of tea, and Shelley said, "Oh, wouldn't that be nice?" And so they sat in the living room, which was really the lounge. Shelley Small didn't take more than one sip of the tea. That was just a prop, as they would say in the world of theater, just a piece of furniture, so to speak, allowing her to sit in Dottie's house on that autumn day while the light shifted through the room. That cup of tea, Dottie saw, gave her permission to talk. And to the best of Dottie's ability, as she recalled it later, this was the gist of what Shelley said. Dr. Small had served in Vietnam years ago with another physician, a man named David Sewell. They were never in danger in Vietnam, Shelley claimed. It was quite dull, really. They worked in a hospital in a safe area toward the end of the war, with plenty of notice to leave the country in time. They were not hanging from helicopters during the fall of Saigon, nothing like that. Nor did they, in the hospital, even see a lot of awful stuff, really. Shelley didn't want Dottie to get the impression that these men were traumatized the way so many people were. Well, you know, those who served. Okay. Slapping her hands gently down onto her black slacked thighs. So, when Richard came home from the war, he met Shelley on a train that was heading to Boston. And after a year, they got married. And David was their best man. David later became a psychiatrist and married a very pretty woman named Isa. They had three sons. The Small family and the Sewell family were friends. They lived in the same town outside of Boston and were both involved with fundraising for the orchestra and, oh, you know how things are. You get a set of friends, and the Sewells were their friends. The wife, Isa, was always a little odd, unknowable, very restrained, but a nice woman. David drank too much. Everyone knew that. But he managed not to show up at the office with drink on his breath. Being a doctor or a minister, those were the two professions where you could never have drink on your breath. And the sons, oh, it didn't matter. They were how sons are. Two turned out fine, one not so fine. Isa was always worried. David was often strict. And the point is, that after 30 years of marriage, David and Isa divorced. It shocked everyone. There were other couples you'd have placed money on way before you'd have placed any money on the Sewells splitting up. But there you are. Shelley Small raised her thin wrists, palms upward, and gave a tiny shrug that was somehow very serious. "We had our own troubles, you know," she said. "For years, I kept the name of a divorce lawyer in my desk drawer. Right up until we renovated the cottage on the lake for what will be our retirement home," she said. Dottie nodded her head just once. It was Isa who had done the splitting, finding some man in a painting class that David, ironically, had pestered her to sign up for because he thought she was getting depressed. And David was livid, absolutely went to pieces. There were times he came to the Smalls' house and just wept, and Shelley had a hard time seeing that, to be honest. It was probably very old-fashioned of her, but she did not like to see a grown man cry. Richard was good. It irritated him. He found it tiresome, but he took it in stride, as any good friend would do. And then, after a couple of years of different women that David brought around, oh, Shelley wasn't going to go into them because they weren't the point. The point was Annie. Annie Appleby. Here Shelley sat up straighter, bent slightly toward Dottie, and said, "She was really special." Dottie did not find it hard to listen to this. "The thing about Annie, well, first, you must realize she is very tall, about 6 feet, and she's thin, so she seems really tall, and she has long, dark, wavy, almost corkscrew hair. Honestly, I often wondered if there wasn't something else mixed in there, you know? Maybe something else, along with some North American Indian? She comes from Maine. Her face was lovely, lovely! The finest features and blue eyes and, oh, how can I say this? She just made you happy. She loved everything. And when David first brought her around..." Dottie asked how they had met. Shelley's cheeks flushed red. "Richard would kill me for telling you, but she was a patient of David's. Well, he could have lost his license, but he did it the right way. He said he couldn't be her psychiatrist anymore. Look, the point is, this happens sometimes, and it happened with them, and he brought her around. Though it had to be a real secret, of course, how they met. They made up a story that her mother had known him in college, which was absolute nonsense. Annie was from a potato farm in Maine, for heaven's sake. But she'd been an actress since she was 16. Just left home. Apparently no one cared. And even if she was 27 years younger than David, it didn't seem to make a bit of difference. They were happy. You just loved being around them." Shelley paused and chewed on her lip. Her hair, which was the pale strawberry blonde of someone who had once been a redhead, was thinning the way older women's hair is apt to do, and she had it cut, appropriately is the word that came into Dottie's mind, right above her chin. There was probably nothing very daring about Shelley. There probably never had been. "You know," she said, "Richard was not sure he wanted to move to the lake." Dottie raised her eyebrows, although she did think that Easterners tended to go on without the need of encouragement. This would not be the case with anyone from the Midwest. Incontinence was not valued in the Midwest. "But that's a different story," Shelley said. "Well, sort of," she said. For no reason she could think of, and it may have been nothing more than the way the sun was slanting right then across the hardwood floor, Dottie was suddenly visited by the memory of one summer of her childhood when she was sent to Hannibal, Missouri, to spend a number of weeks with an ancient and unfamiliar relative. She went alone. Her beloved older brother, Abel, had secured a job in the local theater as an usher and therefore stayed at home. And Dottie was terrified. In the way of some children who are accustomed to deprivation, she understood little and did as she was told. Why her decent Aunt Edna could not take her, as she had done before, to this day Dottie did not know. The only memory she brought back was that of an article she read in a Reader's Digest, stacked among meaningless magazines on a dusty windowsill, offering up the tale of a woman whose husband had served in Korea. At home, with small children at the time, this wife, the woman who wrote the article, lived in the United States somewhere and raised the children and waited for each letter from her husband. He finally returned, and there was much rejoicing. And then, one day, about a year later, while her husband was at work and the children were at school, a knock came at the door. A small Korean woman stood there with a baby in her arms. Dottie was just at the age when she read this that her heart, so naive in spite of what she had already learned about life, or rather what she had already absorbed about life, because people absorb first and learn later, if they learn at all. Dottie had been, at the time she read this article, at the age where her heart almost came through her throat as she imagined the woman who opened the door. The husband confessed. He was very sorry for all the disturbance, and it was decided he would divorce his steadfast wife and marry the Korean woman and raise the baby with her. And the steadfast wife, while brokenhearted, helped out. Meaning, she allowed her children to visit her husband's new home, and she gave advice to the young woman, got her into an English class, and when the husband suddenly died, the first wife took in the young woman and her child and helped them get onto their feet until they could move somewhere else and get settled. And even then, at the time she was writing the article, she was helping to put the child through college. A truly Christian story, if there ever was one. All this had made a rather significant impact on Dottie. She wept silently and fulsomely, young girl tears rolling down her cheeks, dropping onto the pages. The woman, betrayed and large-hearted, became a heroine to Dottie. The woman forgave everybody. When it came time for Dottie's own knock on the door, she naturally remembered this story. She came to understand that people had to decide, really, how they were going to live. Shelley Small sat in the armchair, looking at the floor with an expression of misery, and Dottie said, "Where is the house, Shelley?"
"On a lake in New Hampshire."
Shelley sat up straighter, revived.
"We bought it years ago as a small cottage, a darling little place, and we'd go up there weekends and in the summer for most of August, if we could, and I loved it. I loved watching the water change with the sky, and in April there would be flowering laurel trees, just beautiful. I wanted us to retire there."
"And why not?" Dottie said.
"I'll tell you why not. Richard was not for it. And as time went on..."
Shelley leaned forward in her chair.
"As time went on, you see, well, I'll just say this. Being a doctor's wife is not a bowl of cherries. Doctors think they're terribly important, honestly. And I raised the children, and he would tell me I wasn't doing it right. But was he there when the school called to say that Charlotte had just been caught defacing the girls' room in the most disgusting way? No, of course not."
She suddenly laughed.
"Well, Finally, for the first time in our marriage, I put my foot down and I said, if you are not going to join me in rebuilding this cottage into a retirement home for us, then you are not the man I thought you were and not the man for me. She waved a thin arm. That's all water under the bridge. I designed a lovely house. All that was required by the zoning laws was to keep the original footprint of the house. You know, just do that. Keep the original footprint. And I brought in some architects from Boston, and it took almost 2 years. But there it is, a lovely house. We were able to build it up high. It's 4 floors, you know, and also down by digging out a bit of the ground, so really it's 4.5 stories. It's a lovely house. And we have friends come up on weekends, and we'll retire there very soon. Richard's tired of the way things are going. No one can really make a living in medicine anymore. Get back to the Annie girl, Dottie said. Shelley's face took on a quickness of expression. She was hardly a girl, but she did seem it. She did seem like a girl. And Shelley talked on, quietly and steadily. It was getting dark by the time the door opened and her husband came in, and Dottie could see immediately how dismissive he was of his wife and the B&B proprietor sitting in the living room chatting over cold, undrunk cups of tea. He spoke briefly, then went straight to their room, and Shelley, with a rather furtive and quick smile toward Dottie, gathered her things and followed. Annie Appleby was much as Shelley had described her. Dottie found interviews and reviews and blogs and, of course, photographs, and the girl was really exceptional. She did not have that open-faced, shiny thing that actresses so often had, as though they wanted to beam their way right out of the photo and into your lap. Very childlike, Dottie thought actors were, from what she saw on TV when they had their silly interviews, and on the web, too. But Annie didn't look like that. She looked like you could stare at her forever and not know something you wanted to know, that she was not going to let you know. It was a very attractive quality. Dottie could see a psychiatrist having trouble with the likes of her, each week staring at him across the room, or lying down, or whatever it was a patient going to a psychiatrist did. Annie seemed to have stopped being an actress for quite a while, though. Dottie couldn't find anything about what she was up to now. Shelley had said that she and Annie had walked around the lake the last time Annie and David had visited, which was the first time Annie and David had seen the new house. The new house had a visitor's suite downstairs, where Annie and David had right away taken their bags. And Annie had said, "Oh, how beautiful, Shelley. What an amazing job you've done." So then they had taken a walk around the lake, the men walking ahead of the women. And Shelley told Annie things. Of course, Dottie wondered, what things? And of course, Shelley told her without being asked. What I told Annie was that I was older now and it made life different. I mean, Shelley said, straightening the top of her trousers, Annie had this quality that made you feel you could really talk to her. And so that last day, that last time they were at the lake, I told her how I remembered years ago when I was a young girl. A man passed me in the concert hall and said, "Well, you're a pretty thing." And I told Annie this, and I said, "No one will ever tell me I'm pretty again." Dottie had to allow a minute for this to sink in. "And what did she say?" Dottie asked. Shelley cocked her head. "I don't really remember. She had the gift of not saying much, just listening. And you thought it was all going to be okay.
Dottie thought that Shelley had put Annie in quite a tight spot that day, saying no one would ever again tell her she was pretty. Shelley Small did not have the remnants of pretty on her. Perhaps she had once had the remnants of pretty, but Dottie could not see it.
"And I told her other things," Shelley said. "I told her how worried I was about my children's marriages. My younger daughter, well, she'd become quite overweight, and I really didn't understand it. And just the weekend before, they had been at the lake, and I'd watched while her husband encouraged her to eat more. I told Annie all about it. I said, 'Why would he do that?' And Annie said she didn't know. And I told her how my other daughter was just desperate for a different job. Well, I told her private things."
"Yes, I see," said Dottie. "But here's the thing." Shelley pressed her legs together and leaned forward, her hands held together in her thin lap. "After Annie and David broke up, I called Annie and said she could come to the lake herself. We'd be happy to have her any time. I left a message, and she never called back. Never called me back. And so, when David arrived, in one of his weeping states, just weeping away like he did after Isa left him, I told him this, that Annie had never called me back, and he said, 'Of course she didn't call you back, Shelley. Annie thought you were pathetic. She thought you were an idiot.'"
"She didn't think that," Shelley had answered. "And even Richard told David to go easy."
"She did," said David. So Shelley, of course shaken, said, "Oh, David, the whole thing was a little unrealistic anyway, you know, just with the age difference alone." And David said, staring out at the water, "The age difference. Here's what I have learned about the age difference. People think girls like older men because they want a father. Classic theory. But girls want older men so they can boss them around. They're wearing the pants, I can tell you that. She was nothing but a whore." This made Shelley very uncomfortable, and she told the men she was going to start dinner. And then she hesitated and said, "David, I put your stuff downstairs in the guest suite, but maybe you don't want to stay there because, you know, that's where..."
"That's where nothing," David said. "That's where Annie recoiled from me and said she hated this huge new house. She said, 'This house is Shelley's penis.' That's what she said."
Here, Shelley stopped telling the story. Unmistakably, tears popped into her eyes. Dottie wanted to laugh out loud. Oh, she really did. Dottie thought it was one of the funniest things she'd heard in a very long time. And then she glanced up at Shelley and saw that, in spite of what Dottie always thought was a placid front that she, Dottie, presented to the world, Shelley Small had felt Dottie's desire to laugh. And she was furious. Well, she would be furious, Dottie understood. After all, the point of the woman's story was that Annie had humiliated her. Humiliation is not to be laughed at. Dottie knew that well. Still, Dottie arranged the crocheted doily that covered the armrest of the chair she sat in. She was aware within herself of some contest of feeling. She felt for Shelley. And yet, Dottie could tell by the light that had passed through the room that Shelley must have been talking for almost 2 hours. About herself. Oh, about Annie and David and her daughters, but really, she was talking about herself. Had Dottie talked about herself for so long, she'd have felt that she had wet herself. This was a matter of different cultures. Dottie knew that, although she felt it had taken her many years to learn this. She thought that this matter of different cultures was a fact that got lost in the country these days. And culture included class. which of course nobody ever talked about in this country because it wasn't polite. But Dottie also thought people didn't talk about class because they didn't really understand what it was. For example, had people known that Dottie and her brother had eaten from dumpsters when they were children? What would they make of it? Her brother, for years now, had lived in a huge, expensive house outside of Chicago and ran an air conditioning company. And Dottie was trim and neat and really quite caught up on world events and ran this B&B very effectively, so what would people say? That she and her brother Abel were the American dream, and that the rest who still ate from dumpsters deserved to do so? A lot of people would secretly feel this way. Shelley Small, with her big husband and thinning hair, might very well feel this way. Shelley Small had been raised to speak about herself as though she was the most interesting thing in the world. Listening to her, Dottie almost admired this. Because even having, perhaps, caught Dottie's desire to laugh, Shelley could not be stopped. She was speaking now of the people in this town where their lake house was, how these people had been pleasant and welcoming before the renovation. Now neighbors drove by without even waving. One had stopped, rolled down his window, and accused her of spoiling the lakefront with a McMansion. "Oh, honestly," Shelley said. "Imagine such foolishness. We kept the original footprint." Dottie stood up and walked to her desk, pretending that something there required her attention, all this to avoid having Shelley see her face. "Sorry, but if I don't put this bill on the top of my papers, it won't get paid." Dottie rustled some papers and added, "I don't believe Annie said any of those things about you. She doesn't sound like a person who would say that at all."
"But of course she said it,"
Shelley wailed from her chair in the living room. "That your house was your penis?" Dottie didn't often say the word penis, and she enjoyed it. She came back around from behind her desk and returned to sit near Shelley again. "Does that really sound like what this Annie would say? David, this house is Shelley's penis?" Shelley Small's cheeks were quite red.
"I don't know."
"Well, true enough," Dottie agreed. "You don't. But I think, if you really think about it, well, isn't saying that the house was your penis something a psychiatrist would say? Think about it, Mrs. Small. Who thinks in those terms? Why, my friends and I might say things about other people we know, but we don't go around saying their house is their penis. Look at this house. This is my house. Would you say to Mr. Small, would you say to Dr. Small tonight, this house, this bed and breakfast, is that woman's penis?" And right then, the door opened, and Dr. Small walked in, with all the breezes of an Illinois autumn surrounding him. "How are you, ladies?" he asked, unbuttoning his coat. "Shelley?" As though the poor wife should not sit and chat with a B&B proprietor. And off she followed him to their room. What Dottie had not understood until the Smalls came to stay, was that there were different experiences she attended to in this business that made her feel either connected to or used by other people. For example, there had been the dear, dear man who came in one night about dinner time, a man almost but not quite her age, and took his room and then decided he'd rather watch television. And she'd sat with him watching one of those British comedies. Oh, Dottie thought they were funny, and she tried not to laugh out loud since this man was not laughing, when she became aware that he was in serious distress. He began to make a noise that she had never heard before. It was not entirely unsexual in its sound, but it was a sound of terrible pain. Unspeakable pain, she often thought later. He mimed to her as she quietly asked questions, and Dottie found it remarkable how much they were able to understand each other. First thing, she'd asked if he needed a doctor, and he shook his head and waved a hand in a way that indicated this was nothing a doctor could help with. Tears began slipping sloppily down the man's deeply creased face. Oh, bless his poor soul, she always thought, remembering him. Okay, she had said, and she sat on the couch next to him, and he looked at her so searchingly, so deeply. She had never been looked at by any man so deeply, she thought, or looked at a man that deeply herself. And he was positively mute. Even though earlier, asking for a room and then permission to watch television, he had most certainly been able to use words. She stayed calm and made statements he could either agree with by nodding or disagree with by a dismal shake of his head. For example, she said, I'm going to stay right here to make sure you're all right. And he nodded, those poor, tired eyes searching hers. She said, Something seems to have happened to you, but you will be okay, I think. She said, I'm not frightened by this, just so you know. And that caused a sudden extra burst of effluvia from his eyes, and he squeezed her hand hard enough to almost break it. Then he held up the same hand in what Dottie took to be a gesture of apology. She said, No worries. I know you meant no harm. He shook his head sadly in agreement. Dottie could no longer recall every part of this, but the two of them did, it seemed to her, communicate quite well, all things considered. And apparently there were many things to consider. And she was able, by asking, to find out that at midnight he could take a pill and sleep for 5 hours. All righty, she said. But not too many pills, am I correct? He had nodded. And in this way, really, it was a remarkable event. They had spent the evening together, while he seemed to wash out his very soul in front of her. At midnight she brought him water and walked him to his room and told him where her room was, should he need her. And then she had raised an index finger and said, Not an invitation, which I'm sure you understand, but I always feel it's best to be clear about things. And he had almost laughed. With real mirth, she could see his eyes relax. And they had this sort of not out loud but quite riotous laughter about what she had said. He left at 7 in the morning, a tall man, and not altogether bad looking now that his face was washed by rest. And he had said, I thank you very much, with embarrassment and sincerity. She did not ask if he needed breakfast. She understood the awkwardness of his being served eggs and toast by a woman who had seen something she had not been meant to see, that no one had been meant to see. And so he left. They always did leave. She kept his registration form, the way a child would keep a ticket stub as a souvenir of a special day. Honest as a brook in spring, the entire thing had been. She never looked him up on the internet, nor was she ever tempted. Charlie McCauley was his name. Charlie McCauley of the unspeakable pain. The next morning at breakfast, Shelley did not acknowledge Dottie. Not even a thank you for the whole wheat toast. Dottie was very surprised. Her eyes watered with the sudden sting of this. But then she understood. There was an old African proverb Dottie had read one day that said, After a man eats, he becomes shy. And Dottie thought of that now with Shelley. Shelley was like the man in the proverb. Having satisfied her needs, she was ashamed. She had confided more than she had wanted to, and now Dottie was somehow to blame. As Dottie thought about this, going back and forth between the kitchen and the dining room, she saw Shelley Small as a woman who suffered only from the most common complaint of all. Life had simply not been what she thought it would be. Shelley had taken life's disappointments and turned them into a house. A house that, with the clever use of the right architects, had managed to stay within the legal code, yet became a monstrosity as large as Shelley's needs. Tears had not popped into her eyes over her daughter's obesity. No, they came to her when she reported the assault upon her vanity. She had won against her husband the war of the house, but it had not been enough. What Dottie had not said to her, because it was not her place, was that Shelley had a husband who would break into song at the breakfast table with her in a room with strangers sitting nearby, and that was no, excuse me, Dottie thought, small thing. To listen to a person is not passive. To really listen is active, and Dottie had really listened. And Dottie thought that Shelley's problems, her humiliations, were not large when you considered what was happening in the world. When you considered the people dying of starvation, getting blown up for no reason, being gassed by their own government, you choose it. This was not the story of Shelley Small. And yet, Dottie had felt for her small, yes, small, moments of human sadness. And now Shelley could not return the decency of even looking her in the eye. This kind of thing Dottie did not care for. She would like to know who would. When Shelley did glance over her shoulder to inquire whether there was more jam to be had, Dottie said there was, of course. In the kitchen, and while it was a terribly conventional form of revenge, she spit in the jam and mixed it up and spit again, as much as she could gather in her mouth, and took some pleasure in seeing the jam bowl empty by the time the Smalls left. People had been spitting in the food of those they served most likely since the beginning of time. Dottie knew from experience that the ease this provided was very short-lived, but then most ease was short-lived. And that is how life was. Shelley was out for the entire day, and the couple did not return to their room until very late. That night, Dottie heard, and she was surprised, so much suppressed giggling coming from the bunny rabbit room that she got out of bed and walked in her slippers down the hall. And what she heard was Shelley Small making fun of Dottie in terms Dottie found outrageous. These terms had to do with Dottie's body parts ostensibly not having been made use of in quite some time. And Dr. Small, not surprisingly, was quite graphic during his part of the discussion, and they had a very merry time doing this, as though Dottie was a clown on stage tripping over shoes too large. Their humor was like that. And then began, as Dottie realized would happen, the sounds of people, as her decent Aunt Edna had put it, who love each other. Only Dottie did not hear the sounds of love. She heard sounds from the man that made her think how some women thought of men as pigs. Dottie had never thought of men as pigs, but this man did a good imitation. It was revolting and intriguing in the most ghastly way. Listening in the hallway, she did not hear the sounds of a woman enjoying the love of her husband. Instead, she heard the sounds of a woman who would do anything to make herself feel superior to an old lady who was, as Shelley had put it only minutes earlier, so puritanical as to object to almost anything. In other words, the unhappiness of Shelley Small was something she could ease by being a sexual woman, unlike Dottie. But she was not a sexual woman. Dottie could tell. Shelley got into the shower promptly after, and to Dottie, this was always the sign of a woman who had not enjoyed her man. In the morning, only Dr. Small was at the breakfast table. "And will your wife be joining you?" Dottie asked.
"She is packing," he said, unfolding his napkin. "I'll have the oatmeal again, and you needn't prepare anything for her."
Dottie nodded, and after bringing him his oatmeal, she went to help check out the other couple that had been staying there as well. When she returned to the dining room, Dr. Small was just standing up, throwing his napkin onto his oatmeal bowl. Dottie felt a deep sense of revulsion. She had been used. Placing her hands on the top of a dining room chair, she said calmly, "I am not a prostitute, Dr. Small. That is not my profession, you see." Unlike his wife, who turned red quickly when surprised or embarrassed, this man turned pale, and Dottie knew, because Dottie knew many things, that this was a far worse sign.
"What in the world do you mean by that?" he finally said.
He seemed unable to help but add,
"Jesus Christ, lady!"
Dottie stayed exactly where she was. "Precisely what I said is what I mean. I offer guests a bed, and I offer them breakfast. I do not offer them counsel from lives they find unendurable." She closed her eyes briefly, then continued, "Or from marriages that are living deaths. From disappointment suffered at the hands of poor friends who regard their houses as a penis. This is not what I do."
"Jesus," said Dr. Small, who was backing away from her. "You're a whack job."
He bumped into a chair and seemed almost ready to fall. He straightened himself and said, pointing a finger, shaking it at her,
"You shouldn't be dealing with the public. Good Christ."
He walked into the living room, then headed up the stairs.
"I'm surprised no one's reported you, though I suspect they have. I'll go online myself, by God."
Dottie cleared the dishes. Calmness had come to her quickly and quietly. No one had ever lodged a complaint against her. Nor would Dr. Small, who most likely could barely use the Internet. His materials, she remembered, had been in a binder his first morning at the breakfast table. Dottie waited until she heard the Smalls descending the stairs. Then she went and held the front door open for them. She did not say, "Fly safely," because she did not care if they flew right into the sea. But when she saw Shelley's red nose, the drop of fluid hanging from its tip, Dottie felt momentarily sad. But Dr. Small said, as he pushed past Dottie with his suitcase,
"What a goddamn whack job, Jesus Christ."
And then Dottie felt the wonderful calmness come to her again. She said politely, "Goodbye now," and closed the door behind them. Then she went and sat behind her desk. The house was absolutely silent. In a few minutes, she saw the Smalls' rental car drive from the driveway, and then she took from the far back of her top drawer the slip of paper with the lovely man's name on it, Charlie McCauley. Charlie McCauley of the unspeakable pain. Dottie kissed two fingers and pressed them to his signature. Snowblind. Back then, the road they lived on was a dirt road, and they lived at the end of it, about a mile from Route 4. This was in the north, in potato country,
And back when the Appleby children were small, the winters were icy and snow-filled, and there were months when the road seemed impassably narrow. Weather was different then, like a family member you couldn't avoid. You took it without thinking much.